Welcome back to the program. For over 200 years, we have lived in a Western-centric world in which modernity and progress were defined as being Western. However, today, China stands astride the world, and the question is, will China become subsumed in Western hegemony, or will the West bend to a new way, a new approach, a new paradigm of politics, business, culture, and innovation? These are the questions raised by our guest, Martin Jakes. He's the co-founder of the UK think tank Demos. He writes a regular column for The Guardian. He's a visiting research fellow at the London School of Economics, Asia Research Center, and the author of a new book entitled When China Rules the World, The End of the Western World, and the Birth of a New Global Order. Martin Jakes, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you here, Martin. One of the things that you talk about is that this story about the rise of China is much more than just an economic story, more than a business story, which we tend to look at it, but it's also a political and a cultural story.
Yes, I mean, the interesting thing is that so far, if you look at the bookshelves and the vast majority of articles that have been written, they've treated China as almost solely an economic phenomenon, and with the assumption that the rise of China will simply have economic repercussions and not much wider political, ideological, cultural, moral, military implications. And I think this is completely wrong. I think the rise of China will have profound ramifications in all these respects.
Where do we need to begin to look to see the influence of China in these other areas? Certainly we see it every day in the economic arena. Where do we need to look to see the political and cultural influence of China in the world today?
Well, of course, it's still relatively early days because it's really only since around the turn of the century that China's begun to turn outwards in a broader sense. And even now, it's, of course, overwhelmingly a developing rather than a developed country. And therefore, it's still greatly preoccupied, or overwhelmingly preoccupied, with its own economic growth. Nonetheless, if you take a glance at East Asia, which is, of course, China's own backyard, as it were, home to a third of the world's population, and you can see that the Chinese influence in the region is rising very rapidly, not just economically, but culturally. The turn towards Mandarin, for example, now compulsory language in schools in South Korea and also Thailand, and now Malaysia are considering it. And you can just begin to see in this context Mandarin becoming a second language in the region.
Do we need to look at this? And one of the things you talk about is that the Chinese don't look at this as a zero-sum game. It's not like the Cold War. It's not that China has to rise at the expense of the West. Talk about that.
Well, I think there are two aspects to this. First of all, the rise of China as a global power, which I think is inevitable, maybe to assume the role of the leading global power, I suspect. Now, that inevitably will have ramifications for the United States. I mean, for example, take the role of the dollar, which is struggling at the moment as a reserve currency. Now, I think the rise of China will in time undermine the role of the dollar as the reserve currency of choice in the world. And I would imagine in the longer run, well, it'll probably in the short to medium term be replaced by a basket of currencies. In the longer run, then maybe the Chinese currency, the RMB, will assume a sort of role the dollar's got today, although it'll be not quite the same. So in that sense, the rise of China would be the United States' loss. But in another sense, I think we have to look at it in a broader context, because we're not talking about, what should we say, the rise of China and the decline of the West, absolutely. This is just a relative question. Just as the United States, in its great rise from 1870 onwards, had an enormously positive effect on the global economy and living standards across the world, then so the rise of China is going to have an extremely beneficial, or is already having an extremely beneficial effect on the living standards of many, many people across the world.
Is it a kind of symbiotic relationship where both the West, particularly the United States, and China need each other to accomplish what they need to accomplish?
Yes. I mean, I think that cooperation, above all, between the United States and China is going to be absolutely pivotal to the future. Now, I'm not naive about this. I think that this is a difficult relationship. I think there's going to be conflicts of interest. I think that this will happen across many more areas and subjects than in the past as China becomes increasingly important globally. But the truth is that the key problems in the world will need both countries to cooperate to resolve these problems. So, for example, take climate change. Now, clearly, China and the United States come from very different directions in this context. I mean, the United States has been emitting CO2 on a huge scale for a very long time. China's emissions now exceed those of the United States, but there's very little history because it's been a developing country and therefore has made hitherto very little contribution towards it. So they come from very different positions, but nonetheless, finding a way of the two collaborating from those different histories is going to be extremely important to tackling the problem of climate change.
How does China view its progress? How does it view modernity, and how is that different from kind of the Western view of modernity?
Well, I think that China is, like any country actually, in the throes of modernization, is partly making it up as it goes along. And it's borrowing very heavily. I mean, one of the interesting things about the developing countries that are in the process of modernization is they're having to learn a great deal from the West. I mean, I think that's been a precondition for successful modernization for them. Also learning from each other. I mean, China learned heavily from East Asia, the Asian tigers, and of course, Japan. So the first element of their modernization has been taking on board some of the Western experience. But the other aspect of it is that modernization is not just based on copying, and it's not just based on markets and technology and what have you. It's also shaped by your own history and culture. In fact, I would say that is as fundamental as as the importance of copying and borrowing. So what you have with China is, if you like, as with the other Asian countries, what I would call a hybrid modernity, which is part borrowed and part very indigenous. Indeed, I think it's a precondition for the success of any process of modernization for it to be indigenous as well as borrowed. And China's modernity will profoundly be shaped by its history and culture, to the point where I think we must recognize that Chinese modernity will be very distinctive from any Western modernity.
What do we in the West need to understand about that history and about that culture in order to better read and better understand China on the world stage?
Well, to be honest, I don't think we're barely at the starting point in really understanding China. This strikes me greatly, both from looking at it from Europe and my own country, the UK, but also from the U.S., where I spent some time recently touring to promote the book. And we still have, I mean, a Western ailment, if you like, is that we see developing countries like China through a Western prism. We think of them as developing in the same way as we have. We think their endpoint is somehow a replica or a mimic of our own. This is wrong, and it's a very narrow way of looking. We have to understand China as a very different kind of country from anything that we're familiar with, which has very different historical and cultural coordinates. So, for example, I think that really we can't even see China primarily as a nation state. Now, this is an extraordinary thing to say, because you know, the world in our, has been populated and dominated by nation states, are based on originally the European model for a very long period of time. And it's true that over the last century, China has described itself as a nation state. But China's existed at least for 2,000 years, the oldest continuously existing polity in the world. And China, for the vast majority of that period, was, and in many respects still remains, what I describe in the book as a civilization state. Civilization state defined in two respects. One, that it is a very old state, and secondly, it has a huge geographical and demographic reach. So that within China, China's borders, is an extraordinary diversity, which is only partially recognized in the West, and yet is of extraordinary implication.
What are you seeing as divergent views in the West itself between the U.S. on the one hand and perhaps Europe and your country, the U.K., on the other, in terms of how the West is approaching China?
Well, I think the problem at the moment is that there's a poor understanding of China, not on one side of the Atlantic or on the other, but on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, one of the things that really strikes me about Europe is, continental Europe, even more than Britain, but I would include Britain in this, is that its poor understanding of the rise of China and what its implications are. And I think, to some extent, the same is true of the United States. Now, the United States is more complicated. It's a sort of bifurcated country because, on the one hand, American outlook is, in some ways, extremely insular and totally preoccupied with itself. But on the other hand, because it's a great global power, it has plenty of big-picture thinkers who are concerned with looking at the world as a whole. But even with America, I'm struck by how little understanding we have, or it has, of the rise of China and what its implications will be. And it takes us right back to your first question, which is, you know, why do we look at the rise of China in solely economic terms? Well, I think the reason for that is because we see the rise of China culminating in a society like our own. Wrong. It won't.
Talk about the politics and the governance of China, and how that might change as the nation evolves, and how do we need to better come to understand it, and not try and look at it through our lens?
Yeah. Well, I think we've always got to remember with China where it actually is, because we have a very bad habit of expecting all countries, whatever their level of development, to be like us. And this is a very ahistorical view. I mean, China is still a developing society. It's only halfway through its economic takeoff period. And the vast majority of countries, including the West, did not have universal suffrage during the period of economic takeoff. So to expect of China now the standards that prevail in our own countries is simply wrong. I don't think we can do that. It is true there are some great exceptions like India, but by and large, that's not been the general picture in the world. So I think that we have to bear in mind China's historical place. Now, I would imagine that over time, China will become, as it has over the last 20 years, slowly more open, more accountable, more representative, more pluralistic in the voices that can be heard. I mean, the classic example is on the internet in China now, which has robust discussions on many issues, not all, but on many issues. Now, I think it's not far-fetched to think in the long run that China may develop universal suffrage and even a multi-party system. But I still don't think it'll be like a Western system. I still think it will be very different. And let me give you this point in its strongest form, really. I think that in China, historically and today, legitimacy resides with the state for the reasons of the present communist regime, but even more strongly because of its Confucian history. Now, I think that when China, let's say, has universal suffrage, actually, legitimacy will still rest with the state, because the state is regarded by the Chinese in a completely different way to the way we in Western countries see our own states. We see them as of slightly alien, especially in America, slightly alien, slightly separate from society. The Chinese don't think like this. They think of the state as being the guardian, the embodiment of this, of their civilization, which is a quite different relationship.
What about the cultural influence of China? Certainly when we look historically at great powers, part of the influence comes not just from economics, as we've been talking about, but from countries that are able to put a cultural stamp, even in the realms of fashion, music, and other things, on the world. To what extent is China realizing that?
Well, I think only at the moment in a very limited way, simply because it's still a very much, as I've said, a developing country. And therefore, its ability to project itself, indeed its ability to spend time and money on thinking about cultural questions and engaging in cultural activity in a poor country, remains very limited. But I think we will underestimate China's ability in the longer run to do this at our peril, or peril's probably not the right word, because I think in many ways, many aspects of Chinese culture will come to enrich the world. Now, I've heard many times people say, oh, well, you can't be serious. I mean, you know, how's China going to project itself culturally in comparison with the United States? And but I think that China will be an extraordinary cultural influence. And I say this for two reasons. First of all, if you look at the history of Chinese civilization, then its strongest card has generally been its culture. This is a very rich culture. You know, one of the earliest written languages in the world, a magnificent literature. In Confucius, who lived at the same time as the Greek philosophers, one of the great philosophers of the world in this context, in terms of especially government and the moral ethos that should govern ruling and so on. And so I think that China is is an enormous country of cultural riches, which has largely had so far little influence on the world over the past 200 or 300 years, but I think will come to have a great influence. And I'll give you just a couple of small examples in the contemporary context of how we can begin to kind of imagine what that might be like. First of all, the Beijing Olympics, the building, the Bird's Nest, the great stadium, magnificent building, but also the opening ceremony where they sought in the most modern forms to project a sense of Chinese history, and many people across the world saw it, and were profoundly impressed by that. Now, hitherto, China's not really been able to do this kind of thing because it just didn't have the money, but as it gets the money, it will steadily, I think, be able to project itself. The other example is Chinese film. Now, until really the end of the last century, only a decade ago, Chinese film was essentially in the West art film. But it's had some real blockbusters recently, including Hero, with some major several major directors and some great stars. And you've begun to see, including in the United States, Chinese films becoming a big box office. And of course, Chinese films are about, by and large, Chinese history, Chinese characters, Chinese problems, and Chinese values. And we'll begin to see that on a much bigger scale. But that isn't even the tip of the iceberg. This is just the very twinkling of a beginning, if you like.
Given the rapidity of Chinese growth, which is essentially unprecedented historically, the speed at which the nation is developing, what are the dangers for China and the places that it could stumble as it moves forward?
Well, I think you've got to say that they're manifold. There are no guarantees associated with this development, even though for the last 30 years, despite many critics, China's confounded those critics with a growth rate of more or less double digits for those three decades. What might go wrong? Well, let's try and imagine, first of all, that the present period of global growth, which we were used to prior to the global financial crisis, is not resumed. And in particular, Western markets, which have been very important to China, are subject to extremely slow growth or even relative stagnation. Now, that will confront the Chinese with some serious problems. Now, they've managed to negotiate their way around this over the past year or so by a big stimulus package. But it will be much more difficult for them to do that over a period of several years because it is a very expensive operation, even though the state is extremely well-funded, the opposite to most Western states and certainly the United States government. So that's one problem. A second problem could be the effect of growing inequality. Now, China, from being under the during the Mao period an extremely egalitarian society, given its extraordinary size, has become an increasingly and now very unequal society, which is causing a certain amount of disaffection, a feeling that maybe the growth isn't being the dividend of growth isn't being shared properly, and that could be a source of under certain circumstances, let's say. Low growth, living standards not growing as quickly as they have been previously. That could be a source of social instability and social protest. So those would be two obvious examples. Personally, I expect China to carry on growing reasonably rapidly, probably not as rapidly as it has been. But I think that overall, given it's only halfway through its takeoff period, given still half the population live in the countryside, I think my bet is that it's still got a lot of legs.
One of the things where we see tremendous growth and influence around the world is we suddenly see the Mandarin language being extended all over. Talk a little about that.
Well, of course, we should always bear in mind, as insular Westerners, that twice as many people in the world speak Mandarin as a first or second language, as speak English. In other words, Mandarin is by far the world's leading language. But the point is, of course, that hitherto and still today, it's spoken overwhelmingly in China and not, by and large, outside China. But, of course, as a country becomes extremely important in the world, then the desire and the need to learn that language becomes increasingly great on the part of others. Now, the classic example of this phenomenon, of course, is the rise of English. Now, we may call it English, but the real reason why it's become a lingua franca over the past, what should we say, 40 years, since the 1960s, maybe a bit earlier, is because of the rise of the United States as the great global power since the Second World War. Now, with the rise of China, then the desire of people to learn, to speak, and to read and to write Mandarin, difficult, very difficult as that is for those who've learnt Western languages, I think will become increasingly great. And I described earlier how you can see that phenomenon now beginning to develop in East Asia. And I would anticipate the East Asian economy, as is happening already, being reconfigured around China with enormous political and cultural implications for East Asia, to the point where it would make sense, I think, for Chinese ultimately to become a lingua franca in the region alongside English, or maybe in time, although it will take time, quite a lot of time, replacing English or usurping English as the dominant lingua franca. Now, I don't expect that to happen on the same scale elsewhere, but I do think that it will become extremely important for people around the world to learn to speak Mandarin, and I include in this the West. Now, hitherto, particularly my country, the UK and the US, have been very lazy about the need to learn other languages. We think that as everyone speaks English, then we don't really need to learn languages, another language. But imagine a situation where, you know, 2025, around there, China overtakes the size of the American economy. 2050, these are Goldman Sachs projections, not my own fantasies. The Chinese economy will be approximately twice the size of the American economy. So China is going to become more and more influential. Now, by then, you know, we will need to really understand this phenomenon. We can't get away with just thinking in terms of Western concepts. We will have to learn about Chinese culture. We will have to immerse ourselves in China in a way that we've never really been required to in recent times, understand another country, understand the what makes it tick. And to do that, you know, to unlock that treasure trove, you need to know the language. So the importance of learning Mandarin will become very great indeed. And so for us insular Americans and British, we will have to start learning, in particular, Mandarin on a scale that we've never previously dreamt of.
One of the things that we're seeing that you talk about when China rules the world is more and more developing nations in East Asia, in Africa even, falling into to Chinese orbit. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, it's not a really a very good way of understanding China at the moment to think of it simply its relationship with the West. Because where Chinese influence is greatest, and where the Chinese indeed have focused their attention is not on the relationship between China and the West, but between China and the developing world. And the reason for that, I think, is, it is several fold. I mean, first of all, China's greatest need is for commodities in order to supply its meet its economic growth. And of course, if you look at the countries that it can get its commodities from, then, you know, East Asia, Africa, Latin America, Australia. So by and large, from the developing world. And that's where China's really concentrated its energies. And secondly, Chinese exports in large measure, in significant measure, go to these countries too. Also, you know, there's been a huge expansion over the last decade of Chinese overseas investment. This overwhelmingly goes to the developing world. Very little of it so far has gone to the developed world. So China has been really establishing a close relationship with, an increasingly close relationship with many developing countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And of course it has also a sense of affinity with them, because China is not a developed country by and large. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are elements of a developed country about it, but overwhelmingly it remains a developing country. So therefore, you know, it has much in common with them. And it's not surprising under these circumstances that China's become an increasingly interesting for these countries, and increasingly these countries are studying and learning, I think, from the Chinese experience. I mean, China, of course, comes offering some considerable economic bounty in terms of aid, the possibility of large-scale investment and loans. For example, China loans to Africa more than the World Bank does. And also, these countries are interested in how China, over the last 30 years, has managed to grow at such an extraordinary rate. So therefore, there's interest in what might be described as a Chinese model.
And to that extent, has the West almost agreed to, almost acquiesced to these developing nations falling into China's sphere of influence?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's happened almost by stealth. I don't mean that China has done it sort of furtively. But I mean that it's happened so quickly and in such an unannounced way that the West, take the United States as a classic example, has barely noticed it or has barely clocked it or has, you know, it's sort of, I mean, you had a, I mean, partly because America's been so preoccupied, for example, since the end of the last century with the Middle East in particular, and especially, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, that it got hugely distracted from everything else. I mean, it just took its eye off the global ball, I think, in many ways. And two classic examples of this are East Asia, you know, which is actually the world's most important, largest economic region, bigger than North America and bigger than Europe. And the rise of China, which has essentially been driven as an economic phenomenon with political and cultural implications, of course. And that process happened while the Bush administration, for example, was totally absorbed by events in the Middle East or Latin America. I mean, as you're very familiar, I'm sure, listeners will know that Latin America is becoming increasingly independent of the United States, with a collection of governments across South America, which are increasingly independent-minded and less orientated towards the United States. And in that context, you know, China's done some important deals with a lot of these countries. So I think that, you know, this is a phenomenon which, I mean, basically the decline of the United States in East Asia and the rise of China in East Asia has been an economic phenomenon. It's not a security phenomenon. It's a military phenomenon. It's an economic phenomenon. I mean, the United States is just much less important than it used to be economically in East Asia, and China is much more important.
And finally, how does the West, and America in particular, need to set itself about doing the thinking and the planning that it needs to do to face this changing world?
Well, I think that one of the big problems facing the United States in particular, I mean, Europe's different because Europe is, you know, has long since really lost a sort of global view and a global role. I think really we're talking about the United States here. And I think the difficulty the United States has had is in coming to terms with what's happening in the world. I mean, it was only 10 years ago, on the eve of the presidential election, that, you know, the incoming Bush administration actually thought that the world stood on the eve of a new American century. I mean, this was an most extraordinary fantasy thinking, because that was not what was happening to the world. And, you know, the American administration then confused military power and economic power. Militarily, the United States looked all powerful, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and so on. But economically, over quite a long period, the world had been moving in a different direction. I mean, the world was becoming characterized by what some people describe as multipolarity. In other words, you know, not just the old developed world of the United North America, Europe, and Japan, but also the new rising developing countries, notably China and Japan. China and India, but also Brazil, South Africa, and so on. Now, the problem is that only 10 years ago, you know, the American leadership got what was happening to the world seriously wrong. Now, I think the present president, Obama, has a much more realistic view of the world. And with the onset of the global financial crisis, it's been a chastening experience. You know, America seriously in debt, China its banker, the decline of the developed world. Therefore, what's happened to the G7, G8? I mean, it's almost disappeared in the context of this crisis. The rise of the G20, there's now a sort of catching up process taking place, which is trying to understand what the world really is like, as opposed to what it was perceived to be like in the sort of mistaken days of 10 years ago. So what worries me is that this process is happening, you know, late in the day, very little sort of prior thinking about it. So it's all on the basis of a sort of catch-up in a world which is looking increasingly unfamiliar to the West, and in particular to the United States. Now, I do think there is something dangerous about this. and that is that the less able we are to appreciate the world that we live in, the more likely we are to be shocked by it and surprised by it and ambushed by it. Whereas if we have some sense of what's happening, and I think what the sense of what's happening is, you know, get some sense of what the decline of the United States is and what the processes are and what the causes are and so on. Now, some of those causes can be tackled, but others, in my view, cannot be, because that's just the way history is. You know, we don't all occupy the place in the sun forever. You know, nations rise and fall. And the United States is not going to fall, but it's going to be in a process of relative decline. And it needs to understand that process, and the extent to which it understands it and can go with the flow and deal with those things that can be dealt with, but not understand that some of those things can't be dealt with, that it will have a new, reduced, diminished role in the world, then the better American policy will be, and the better the American people will understand what's happening. But if it's the whole process takes place like a series of ambushes, then people are going to be shocked, disorientated, dislocated, will, you know, potentially lash out in the wrong way in response to it.
Martin Jakes, his book is When China Rules the World, The End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order. It's just out from Penguin Press. Martin, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you.